what we're about to engage in is not happy talk, but real talk. So at the very least, you can kind of prepare yourself for some of what's to come. And this gentleman is somebody who can break it down like nobody else can. Former New York congressman, the first practicing CPA to make it to Congress, one of the accountants who participated in the financial rescue of New York City in the 1970s, and subsequently the SNL business. He is just coming off a run for the U.S. Senate, and he is perennially somebody who is prepared to talk on these issues as a representative from Truth in Government, our friend Joe DiAguardi. Joe, a pleasure to have you back on the lounge tonight, sir. How are you, my friend?
Thank you, Rick, and no apologies necessary. I enjoyed listening to the commentary. I'm happy to be back, and there's a lot to talk about. You better give me the questions, because if I start talking, I may not stop.
All right, well.
There's a lot going on. The states, the federal government, the world, we are in a mess. Go ahead, Rick.
I do want to ask you a little bit about the world subsequently, because we'll hit that before we're done. I know, as a former congressman from New York, and I know how sort of Israel-obsessed the state of New York is, so I know you're familiar with the Middle East from your time in Congress, if nothing else. But on these other issues here, and a lot of people are making surface comparisons, and they're ones that I find to be quite lazy comparisons. When you look at what's happening in Madison, Wisconsin, when you look at what's happening in Cairo, and in some of the other capitals of the Middle East these days. But this showdown that's been brewing in Wisconsin, it's getting billed by the media, and I find it hard to say that I, for once, seem to agree with the big media. It does seem to be, in a nutshell, a representative of the major forces at play here. You have the government unions, you have the powerful institutions that have been a foot on the gas pedal for permanent raises in spending. You have a Tea Party governor who's come in, who says we're broke, we got to rein it back, we got to have austerity, and if we don't have austerity now, it's going to be horrific austerity down the road because of how badly we're broke. And that kind of ties into some of the things you've been talking about. So I guess we'll start there, Joe. What's happening in Madison as a microcosm of the country and maybe perhaps a good swath of the world?
Well, you know, it gets back to the accounting. It may sound a little mundane to you, but you remember what people used to say under the Clinton administration, it was the economy stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I'm beginning to say now as I go around, it's the accounting stupid. Let me tell you why. You've had, over the years, negotiations between the state officials and these unions whereby they would kind of wrap things up at the end by saying, okay, we won't raise the wages, but please give us as much as you can on the pensions. Well, it turns out, if you look at the evolution of the accounting for pensions, the private sector and the public sector is way behind the private sector in recording the liabilities for unfunded pensions. And now we found out that many of these states have not paid in what they said they were going to pay in. Look at Chris Christie. He said, I'm not paying in that $1.4 billion bucks. We don't have it. We're broke. So what you have now is things are starting to catch up with us, because the unfunded pensions were kind of like off the books. People said, well, let's kick that can down the road. That'll be paid for later. But guess what's happening? Moody's and Standard & Poor's, read the articles in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times. Now they're getting worried, and they're saying, you know what? These states are starting to bother us, and we could have some defaults here, not just states, counties, cities. So they've decided to put now the unfunded liabilities for these pensions and other things, health care benefits, along with bonded debt. In other words, these entities, municipal entities, borrow money. It's called bonds. And if you add now the unfunded pension liabilities to that to determine the bond ratings, you're going to find the interest costs going out of sight for these entities. So it's no longer an academic exercise. Now, the reason why you're hearing it today and not years ago is that back in 1974, when I was a partner in those days, the world's largest accounting firm, Arthur Andersen, I was one of the partners in charge of something called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. That's when they started to get the idea that we need to control or at least report adequately these pension costs. And I remember one time the president of General Motors, I think it was Roger Smith in those days, went before the Financial Accounting Standards Board to say, no, don't do it. Don't do it. We can't, you know, afford right now to put all those liabilities on our books. Well, the accountants decided that generally accepted accounting principles required that we report those liabilities, and actuaries had to be hired to compute those liabilities properly. That's why the private sector over the years shifted from defined benefit plans, these pension-type plans, to what we call defined contribution plans. And what are those? Those are your 401ks. The public sector hasn't made that transition. Why? Because the Government Accounting Standards Board, which is the equivalent for the Financial Accounting Standards Board in the private sector. You got GASB in the public sector for the state, cities, and other public sector entities, and you've got FASB in the private sector. Well, it's only now that GASB is starting to come up with the same rules. So things now are going to be put on the books. And what has Joe DiGuardi been saying since he was a congressman? We're spending money we don't have. And by the way, we're not recording properly what we're spending because the government is not using what they call generally accepted accounting principles in the budget process, and that's the federal government. And now we see that even though the states are required to use generally accepted accounting principles, they didn't apply those rules when it came to unfunded pensions. So everything now is coming home to roost. Now, in terms of Wisconsin, I see it this way. I see that the taxpayers need to be represented. You know, when you have the private pension people and the unions, when you have the unions in the private sector and they have negotiations, the unions and the employees know not to go too far. Why is that, Rick? Because you can put that entity out of business. Then you don't have any jobs. The public sector has been acting differently. They've been saying, well, listen, we know that if they can't afford it, they'll just raise taxes and it'll come back to us. So we don't care. We're going to push all the way. We're going to use collective bargaining all the way. And, you know, that's it. We want what's ours. Well, again, I say, who's representing the taxpayers? Now, obviously, public employees are taxpayers, too. But there are more taxpayers doing other things in the state than just the public employee, union people. So my feeling is that I'm glad that this debate is happening, and I'm glad this confrontation is happening, because it just tells you that we are unsustainable in the federal government, and now we've got large states like California, New Jersey, New York, Illinois, trying to now bond some of their debt again, and we don't know if they're going to be able to do it next week. They postponed it last week. And you got Wisconsin and probably several others that are unsustainable. So where are we going? As Chris Christie said, hey, the game's over. We have no more money.
Well, not only that, Joe, it's a situation where there's a lot of people who are looking at the other side of the books in Wisconsin, and they're looking at some of the tax cuts that have been passed recently. And it's true, and there are situations, of course, where some tax cuts, not all, but some are dynamic in the sense where, because of the Laffer curve, you cut taxes to a certain point, you can make up for it and maybe even get more revenue in the end because of the increased activity that takes place, the increased activity that you generate and stimulate. Again, not all tax cuts do this. Some of them do. But for a situation like Wisconsin, that's separate from the federal government, where the primary purpose of cutting taxes is to try to stimulate growth. You also have Wisconsin, one state among 50, trying to lure economic activity from some of these other states. You got a state like Illinois, which just raised taxes out the gill here. There's a lot of people who are really demonizing Scott Walker and what they have done in the legislature here in Wisconsin. But from a growth perspective in Wisconsin, if you want to be able to bring in revenue in the medium and long term, you try and steal from Illinois. You try and get some of these businesses to come up north here. So you've got the tax side, and you've also got the spending side here, and it's not at all inconsistent, as of course you know, to work one way and the other one the other way.
Well, you're making a good point, because those tax cuts were motivated in great part to create jobs, to create growth. There's no question. So they're not contradictory to what is going on the other side. You have to use all the tools that you have in order to play the game today. And one is You got to grow, and the federal government, by the way, has the same thing. Here we want to cut the deficits. We want to cut the national debt. Everybody's concerned about it because we know if they keep going up, what happens? Interest then becomes very high, and that interest has to be paid, and that's the biggest tax of all because it goes to people with money. Much of it will go to foreign countries like China, or a good chunk of it, and therefore, you know, that's it doesn't go for roads or education or schools. That's the highest tax of all. And Obama's telling us that by the year 2017, he expects the bonded debt to be $20 trillion. God forbid, you mentioned Jimmy Carter. Do you remember what the prime rate was under Jimmy Carter in 1979? I do, because I had a piece of property and I had a mortgage. I didn't pay that high, but I got pretty close, 15%. The prime rate was 21%. Why? Inflation was 18%. You have to reward people by giving them a few more points, you know, when it comes to lending money. Can you imagine if we went anywhere near that? But you know that interest is going to go up. It has to. Bernanke, you know, he doesn't admit it. They don't have an exit strategy. They got to keep the pedal, you know, down to the floor because they want to have this quantitative easing because they know that we're not quite out of this recession yet. We want to create jobs. But sooner or later, the results of this are going to show. And that means with all the money we've been printing and all the money we've been, you know, putting out there, you're going to see inflation come back. And I think in 5 years, you're going to easily see interest rates somewhere between 7 and 10%. And if you take just, you know, the lower part of that range and you're talking about $20 trillion in debt, you are talking about a lot of money. You're talking about $1 trillion in interest. You know what the interest was last year that we paid out? $200 billion. Why was it so low? Because our interest rates right now on short-term treasuries are very low, 1% or less. So, you know, we got to look at this stuff, and that's why we are unsustainable. Because if we keep adding to the national debt and these deficits, we got big problems. And let me tell you, I'm shifting back to the federal government, I know, but we get back to the states. What was fiscal year? Fiscal year is for the federal government is September 30th.
Yeah.
So fiscal year 2010, the deficit was $1.3 trillion. 2011, we just adjusted it. It was supposed to be 1.3, 1.4. It was just adjusted. Look how they adjust these things. $1.65 trillion. And they're predicting next year, and we know we're going to go into a budget fight now for the fiscal year 2012, and Obama is saying that we can expect another deficit of at least $1.1 trillion. At the end of 2012, that will bring the national debt, bonded national debt, not what I'm going to tell you is off the books in a minute, but the bonded debt to $17 trillion. And then he says by 2017, expect us to go to $20 trillion. I mean, he's telling us. Would you believe it? That means he's probably estimating low. It's going to be worse. So we got to wake up America. There's no question about it. And these states are in the same pickle.
Well, to update that old saying from Everett Dirksen, the senator back in, I think, the 1960s here, to update the saying, a trillion here and a trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Well, but, in those days, I think he was using a million here, or maybe a billion there. That worked to tease.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah, he used to say billion, but what a quaint time it was in the 60s when people would get scandalized about deficits in the billions. Those were the days. Actually, those were the days until about 5-10 years ago. But another thing here, too, Joe, in terms of, again, you having been in Congress, you served 3 terms successfully, and as we said previously, tried a few other times to get back here. And as I've said before, I admire, you know, you've never trimmed your sails. You ran in a tough district, and the times when the voters were sufficiently receptive, you got in. The times when they weren't, you didn't. I really applaud that because, again, that's so rare among people running for political office these days. But you understand the way that things have to be framed, as well as you obviously understand the stark reality of it, which you're laying out to us here tonight. I can't help but think this would be a thing. This is a time to think outside the box politically. This is a thing where I would have to say that the Republicans in Congress, I understand that it's counterintuitive, but I think they could really gain a lot of ground and advance these arguments here and push the gravity of the situation if they owned up to all that the Republicans did under George W. Bush to help create this. I mean, I don't think it's a contradictory thing to say George W. Bush is doubling down on everything we did wrong. Yeah, we did some things that were wrong. This guy is taking what we did wrong and going like by a factor of five. Instead, by refusing to admit the culpability of the last 8 years prior to this administration when the national debt was doubled, yeah, this president making George W. Bush look like a piker, but if the Republicans didn't pretend they were coming to this with clean hands, I think they'd be able to sell the urgency of this thing a little bit more.
Well, you're making a good point. In terms of George W. Bush, I'm looking at a chart here. The national debt at the end of the year 2000, fiscal year, was $5,900,000,000, and then by the year, I don't have 2008, but 2005, it went to $8,700,000,000. And then it went to 14 by 2010. So you're right. We did double the national debt. And by the way, we had two wars that were off the books.
Yep.
Gave
yep.
Obama a chance to say, well, I'm going to continue that war in Afghanistan, but I'm putting it on the books. So it made a fiscally conservative president look like he was trying to dodge the numbers. Yeah, I think Bush was a problem in that regard. And we got stuck with two wars that we're still paying for. Look at Afghanistan, $100 billion a year. And if that's not bad enough, 50% of that, and that's like, what, $1 billion a week, is on infrastructure. We're trying to buy the favor of the people over there by building roads and bridges while we have the infrastructure crumbling over here. I've got a bridge here in Westchester County. They're afraid it's going to go down. It's called the Tappan Zee Bridge. We're putting another roadbed in it, but it's already nearly 10 years over its useful life. There's 160,000 cars and trucks going across it each day, which is more than they ever anticipated when they built it, and it's got to be replaced. Where's the money? This is a big problem. And another thing I should say, Obama missed a big opportunity in terms of stimulus when he didn't come up with a massive infrastructure spending project, much like FDR did, to stimulate. Why is that good? Well, number one, you can borrow against an asset that's producing income, and you could privatize a lot of this, and that's what the trend's going to have to be in the future, to show that these bridges and tunnels have enough income from the tolls and whatnot so that they can afford to service the bonds, and I think that's when we're going to have to get the Goldman Sachs involved. There may be some public involvement, but we cannot allow the infrastructure to crumble because then you reduce your economic efficiency. And economists say that if you plan infrastructure well, the return on that, the economic fluidity, is somewhere between 15% and 20%. Well, guess what long-term borrowing is right now if you're a AAA bond rating like the Treasury bills, the federal government? It's 3% for a 10-year bond. So you got a big arbitrage between 3% and 15%. And we should have been doing more than that. It's only now that Obama decided, all right, we're going to do $50 billion worth, and it's not enough. So we could have put a lot of people to work. There's another thing I should tell you, Rick, that we don't separate what we spend for assets from what we spend for everything else in the government. Believe it or not, we don't have what they call a capital budget in the United States of America. And yet last year, we spent, of the budget deficit I mentioned, $500 billion was spent on assets, which you would think would be recorded on the books. No, we put it in as part of the deficit. And then you wonder why we have people earmarking, because you don't have the right planning long-term on what the priorities should be in the states and in the federal government. So we're not running the government the way I saw my clients for 22 years in an accounting firm run, with the right financial management, the right accounting systems, and the right kind of budget processes. Take a look at the budget process. It's one big omelet. I know I'm talking like a certified public accountant, but I'm trying to keep it simple. We should have a separate budget for trust funds. Would you believe we have one budget? It's called a unified budget. Who started it? Lyndon Baines Johnson. Why? He wanted to disguise the cost of the Vietnam War. He knew it was unpopular. He saw the surpluses in the Social Security Trust Fund. He said, why should I show that high deficit when I could now combine the surpluses with the deficits in the other part of government. Now, they should never have done that. They carried that on for 40 years, even though we've had separately earmarked taxes called FICA for Social Security. And in 1982, we ramped up the rate and the base because we knew Social Security might go bankrupt, and we did a damn good job collecting money. But guess what they did every year? They took the surplus and they netted it against the deficit so that we showed an artificially low deficit so that people were being seduced into thinking it wasn't as bad. And what does that tell you about the Clinton years when they said we had 4 years of surpluses? That's a lot of nonsense. If you took out the Social Security trust fund money, there were no surpluses. So we've been gaming the people for years. But think about this big omelet we created. We throw in the capital items with the regular expense items. We throw in the trust funds, and we throw in government-sponsored enterprises, GSEs. What are they? Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, Resolution Trust Corporation that we have. We still have that, believe it or not. You've got the FDIC, the post office. These were supposed to be self-funding entities. Some of them have boards of directors, even have independent audits like the post office. But what else do they have? They can use the full faith and credit of the United States government to borrow. And look at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. When I said in my book, my first version of Unaccountable Congress, it doesn't add up, in Chapter 4, that if we kept spending money we don't have, and if we kept letting Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac just borrow and not put it in the budget the way it should have been, these guarantees and everything else, that we're going to find out that there's going to have to be another bailout. Hey, people said, Joe, come on. You're talking like an accountant. That can't be. We're not going to have any bailout. That's an implicit guarantee. I said, wait a minute. How could it be implicit? The rate of interest back then was 9%, and they're borrowing below 5%. Why? Because people realize that the federal government is standing behind it. Hey, what just happened? We had to bail them out. Worse than that, we now own 70% of the stock of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they had insult to injury. They still don't want to put it on the budget. So we still don't know how bad it is. And you know why they want it on the budget, Rick? Because then they'd have to value those toxic mortgages. There's several trillion dollars worth. I understand there's like $5 trillion worth of mortgages, and they have them on the books right now at $5 trillion. Once you bring it into the budget, someone's going to have to say, well, what are those mortgages worth? Just like a bank has to calculate, you know, what its losses are on certain loans. They're not supposed to wait until they go bad. They have to start estimating. So we have another probably $2 trillion that we haven't calculated sitting in those two funds. And I'm anxious to see what this new plan is to privatize them. I think we need to do that. I think we need to bring in the private sector because government's doing a lousy job with all these entities.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, Joe. And again, nobody knows more about this than you do. Nobody's better able to break it down in terms of the accounting tricks and frauds that government uses to camouflage these things. In our remaining moments here, Joe, I did want to pick your brain about this as well. Some of these matters going on right now, the revolutions in at least two Arab countries thus far, I guess a revolution in progress in Egypt, I guess you'd say, sort of in slow motion with the military in control right now. But, you know, I've kind of gotten into this with one or two of my neocon friends that have been kind of a little bit hippie-ish about, people power, democracy. I'm sitting here, and I'm a consummate realist, John. I'm going, is this going to be better? Yeah, maybe, but we don't know yet. We don't have enough information yet. We do not know what kind of bad characters may come to power. You look at all the revolutions through time, Russia, France, etc. It's the bad guys like the Muslim Brotherhood that is accused of being anyways. I'll editorialize and say I agree with a lot of that. But anyways, you know, these are the factions that kind of tend to come to the fore here. What has your experience from your time in Congress? What kind of insights have you gotten about what are some of the things that might be happening in this unprecedented time in the Middle East?
Well, I can tell you that our State Department has failed to see this coming, and there's a good reason they did. And it reminds me of the work that I did with my wife, Shirley Cloyes, to head off that New Age Hitler dictator, Slobodan Milosevic. He started a war in Slovenia in 1990, then in Croatia in 92, then we had 93, Srebrenica, 7,000 men killed, and then we realized that we made a pact with the devil. And then you had Holbrooke, rest his soul, you know, going to the Dayton Accord, keeps the Albanians off the table because Milosevic said, oh, don't bring them to the table, the third largest ethnic group in the Balkans. So here we are relying on a dictator that is brutal, you know, as part of our foreign policy because we're trying to, you know, keep the peace. Well, when did we substitute oil for human rights when it comes to determining our foreign policies in the United States? Now, I understand that we got to do things which are in our interest, and we got to protect oil supplies. But you know what? I remember being on the gas lines in the 70s. Why did we undo all those policies that were being implemented back then to take us off the gas lines and to make us energy independent? So right away, we had a failed policy in terms of energy independence. So for 30 years, we've been making ourselves more dependent on these dictators like Mubarak, like Gaddafi, and like the others. And look at Saudi Arabia. I mean, forget it. And by the way, they're not immune to this kind of thing, I don't think. Any regime which represses its people the way these regimes have, and this is not 5 years, these guys have been around for 30 years or more, they have to know that at some point the people are going to get fed up. Enough's enough, especially when you have unemployment rates of over 50%, and you've got, you know, a third, what is it, under 30, 70% of the population in Egypt. Hey, come on. These young men are going to get into trouble just sitting around. But why didn't our State Department understand that while we needed their oil, we needed to push them slowly but surely to a kind of democratic system where the people would have their say? No, we just let it go. And we let it say, oh, listen, as long as it's that oil, don't worry about it. And now look what's happening. It's like, you know, what happened with the Resolution Trust Company. We knew that those savings and loan associations were going bad, but we didn't intervene soon enough. So guess what we had to do? A bailout in 1987 cost us $500 billion. That was big money back then. It's big money today. Well, here's what's happening today. It's now a bailout. We're trying to get some substitution of those regimes with the worst dictators. And let's say Mubarak, he sounds like, you know, he looks like your grandfather. He looks like a decent guy. But look at the way he ran the country. I mean, listen to the people. No jobs. It was like a police state.
Yeah.
And Gaddafi's even worse. I mean, he's a nut above nuts. He just said today that I'm not leaving. I'm a revolutionary. And to the last bullet, if I got to put all the oil fields on fire, he wants to be another Saddam Hussein and kill all the refineries, I'm going to do it. Now, what do you do with a guy like that? I hope that our State Department has an answer because they let it go too far. Now, fortunately, we got other countries that are closer, like Italy, which depends on its for its oil, I think, 20%. And Mr. Berlusconi, he's got more problems than just partying. He better now get his act down there with his army or with his best people to figure out how they're going to stop that huge inflow of people from Libya to Italy. But more than that, God forbid this guy lights a fire on those oil rigs and everything else in Libya, we'll have another environmental catastrophe. Bottom line, Rick, is our State Department was sleeping at the switch. We had to know that at some point this could happen. Why over 30 years did we become more energy independent so we wouldn't be in this case today? And why over 30 years did we push to have a transitional movement that could take maybe 10 years? Now, obviously, they're trying to do it, you know, overnight, which is not going to be easy, and there may be more turmoil to come. I'm really sad by what I see on TV, and I don't know what the answer is, except the people are right. They've had enough. They've lived like dogs in police states, no jobs, no ability to speak. It's only now that we've got the social media networks that we're seeing some of this. And China better be worried, and so should Iran, because that's been one of the most brutal states putting down its people. So we got a big problem, not just with our deficits and our national debt. Our State Department has to really now look at everything in a real way, and they better look at what we're spending in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Iraq, I hope we're going to come out with something. But right now, we still have a government that's not that stable, and I'm worried. But they are reducing the troops. Hopefully, we're going to get enough of these Iraqis to take their place. But you still look at the sectarian violence that they have there with the car bombs and the suicide bombers. In Afghanistan, you know, why do we need to declare war in a country where we have 16 intelligence agencies, we have drones? You got to go in there and get the terrorists. But look who our partner is, Pakistan. And Pakistan is not to be trusted, apparently.
Right.
And we got a big problem there. Did we calculate that before we went into Afghanistan?
I don't think so.
And Karzai, we made another partner that's a crook. His brother runs all the poppy industry over there. And Karzai himself was caught trying to get $4 billion of our money into Dubai. I mean, you can write books about this stuff. We can't be that stupid. So I think we've got to now look at that. And by the way, the answer there has to involve India. You can't do anything in Pakistan without looking at the regional implications.
Yep.
And people really don't realize that Karzai is a Pashtun, meaning he's got ethnic roots in India.
Yep.
Still haven't solved the Kashmir border. We're looking at Afghanistan like that's the issue. No. It's much bigger than that, and I don't think we've measured it properly.
Right. I think you're right about that, Joe, and nobody's better at breaking down what's going on in these troubling times than you. That's for sure. Joe, we're fully up against it now. We're going to go to our bottom of the hour break somewhat belatedly. Please give our best to your daughter.
They can go to the website, truthingovernment.org, and they could see the new version of Unaccountable Congress, which spells out the stuff I've been talking about.
Exactly. And please give our best to your family. And, of course, daughter Kara coming out with the American Idol memoirs in the spring here and the new show on Bravo. Please give her our best. And Joe, it's a pleasure. You're always welcome, my friend, and I can't wait. As things continue to develop and we continue to go more and more to hell in a handbasket in the world, we'll have you on to break it down for us.
You got a good partner in Steve Cervillo there. He keeps Cervillo, he keeps tabs on me.
Yeah, Steve's the best. I'm glad he's been involved with you and brought you to our attention. One of millions of great things he's done for us. Thank you so much, Joe. We'll talk to you
again soon, Rick.
My friend.
Good night.
Good night, Joe. Joe DiGuardi, everybody, a great American, former congressman, first practicing CPA ever to go to Congress.